Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 76, titled No Eye, No Ear, No Nose.
Fault of the sun and moon. It's the fault of the person blind from birth. They can't see it. So then Buddha says, even so, Shariputra, my Buddha land is perfect for all the beings in it. It's the ideal evolutionary, incubator for the highest qualities and enlightened qualities of every single being, including every insect and every microbe, as well as the gods and demons and titans, and humans and animals. Everybody's in the best possible place they could possibly be. So Shariputra says, well, I don't know, doesn't look like that to me. And then God, actually, the Brahma, who's one of the head of the gods, one of the head gods, who some of the Indians in that day thought was the creator, although he said he wasn't, to Buddha. But anyway, he shows up and he scolds Shariputra. He says, Shariputra, this Buddha land of Shakyamuni, you just don't have the mind to see it. You're full of dualisms in your mind. It's a fantastic plane for all the beings in it. It couldn't be better for them. Nothing, it's absolutely perfect. And I see it as more perfect than any heaven even, Brahma says. Well, that's okay, says Shakyamuni, but I see it like filled with crap. He literally says, like full of crap, he says. So Brahma says, well, that means, Shariputra, your mind is full of crap. That's what it means. He actually says that. And so Shariputra is kind of quiet. So then Buddha breaks into that conversation and he says, okay, look, I'll give you guys a little demonstration. So he picks up his foot and he puts his big toe. It doesn't say whether he's standing or sitting or what it is. It just says that he took his big toe and he sort of ceremoniously planted it on the ground, on the earth, like that. And then it is said, suddenly everyone in that whole assembly, thousands of people actually, because there were thousands of monks and bodhisattvas and supernatural beings, etc., plus the 500 lichavis, but anyway, and Shariputra, everyone in that assembly suddenly saw themselves as if their body was made of jewel plasma. They were like diamonds and rubies and emeralds. They were like rainbows. They were made of pure light, jewel light. So the earth was pure jewel light. They were sitting in jewel lotuses. They couldn't have been in a more perfect situation for them to learn, to grow, to develop. It was absolutely perfect, and everything was perfect. And they were like breathtaking. They were gasping for breath. They were so amazed. So then Buddha said to Shakyamuni, well, how does it look to you now, Shariputra? And he says, wow, Shariputra, I never could have imagined it was so perfect. And so then everyone has, different people in that assembly had various insights by seeing what they thought of as the solid, intrinsically real world, the way it was with all its imperfections and the way their sight saw it. They suddenly saw it as perfect. And they were like, couldn't be happier and really joyful they were. And they realized, of course, then the malleability of the material planet, since it is voidness, since the matter is voidness, it means that the enlightened mind can shape it in any positive way for anyone. And the Buddha was shaping it like that, temporarily, for their vision of that. Then the Buddha picked up his foot, and then it looked back like the way it had before, like ancient India, wherever on the planet or whatever it was. And then they had a big vision of impermanence, a big insight into how the transformability of everything. Now that event in that sutra, there are things like that in the longer Prajnaparamita sutras also, actually. And so this is just a very short sort of essence, the heart sutra that we read. But this is very vivid, particularly in this sutra and other ones like especially the Lotus Sutra and the Flower Ornament Sutra are very, very visually vivid. A lot of the sutras are. But what it is that it adds to the idea that the world is empty of intrinsic reality and is a pure potential total relativity, and therefore you are responsible for shaping your world in interaction with others, because they're also shaping. It isn't like It's all in your mind. It's in everybody's mind. But and it's also matter between their minds. But they are, the way you are seeing it is very much your responsibility. And if you can imagine it better, then that's improving it, actually. And bit by bit, you do that. And that there's tremendous art. There's an art of how a vision that, of course, Tantra, the Vajrayana, you know, the esoteric teaching that Buddha himself taught, we believe. And we don't believe like Western historians that it's thousands of years later and they made it up and pretend the Buddha did it. That's all very rude stuff of modern scholarship because they can't imagine that there are this kind of higher being that has miraculous ability. They just think everything is matter and you just are like that and that your mind doesn't exist and you die and you cease to exist. They have a very poverty-stricken worldview, actually, in fact. And so do we. We're brought up in it. It takes a real critical effort to shift that worldview, to see the world as totally filled with potential, and to feel tremendous inspiration yourself that you can reshape the world. You are the one who is going to reshape your world, and you have plenty of time to do it because you're going to keep being reborn, period. This is like ultimate Groundhog Day universe. Remember Bill Murray? Kept living that same day until he shaped up and got it right. So the same with us, you know. According to the Buddhist vision from ancient time. Bill Murray is my guru. You know Bill Murray, the actor? Did you ever see Groundhog Day? It's a great thing. He keeps having the same day. He goes to sleep at night, and then it's the same morning, previous morning. Then he keeps doing stupid things because he gets bored with that day, and then it's still the same day. Even he kills himself one time. He jumps over, and again he's born the same day. But only when he's really nice to everybody, like a bodhisattva, finally he gets to another day. Just like that. So anyway, that's the sutra. Then that's adding a dimension. You know, the first dimension from the Heart Sutra that we looked at in terms of inner science was this thing about intrinsic reality, and that's the deep thing, you know, the profound thing. That's the physical basis. Emptiness is actually a physicist's insight. The Buddha was a physicist, and he predicted what they only discovered by 1926 or so, the quantum people, that reality will dissolve under analysis, that there is no, you know, intrinsically real, analysis-resistant building block of nature, like an atom means an indivisible particle, actually, atom in Greek. And there is no such thing. That's a fantasy that we have to make ourselves feel secure, that we have a little solidity around us, you know, an atom is. But he saw at the time there was no such thing. And you can see that. There's an exercise that I will give you now. I want you to go into meditative mode. So I want to so a little bit rub that in. So go into meditative mode now, mental meditation. You can sit. You can just calm down now and just sit. And then think. This is to think. This is Vipassana meditation. This is critical thinking meditation. And now you think you know your nose is right there, right? You think so. And if you're looking down your nose, as you should when you're concentrating and meditating, it's right there in front of you. I always like to say the nose is our lifelong hood ornament, like it used to have on automobiles. And it's right there. But now the challenge is you find your nose. Okay? It's a thought experiment. Okay? So now where is my nose? You sort of see something in your visual field, like a round profile at the end of your nose, going cross-eyed if you have two eyes, right, seeing the tip of it. But then the first thing you want to do is you take your finger and you put it on your nose. You say, well, this is my nose. What's the big deal? But then this is a thought experiment. So what are you touching and with what? Well, depending on how hard you press, you're touching a certain zone of skin with a certain zone of the skin on your finger. And if you have less pressure, you're touching less of it, and more pressure, you're touching more of it. But as you know, you could have an accident, or you could go to a plastic surgeon, and you could have that piece of skin removed and replaced with something else, and you'd still, and so that piece of skin that you're touching is actually not your nose. At the moment, it seems to be a part of your nose that is actually not your nose. And then when you say part of your nose, you're assuming there's a whole nose. But actually, anywhere else you touch on it, will only be this part of the nose. And none of it will be the nose, because you could take any one of those parts away and you'd still have a nose, right? Or then you think, well, maybe how many parts would you have to take away to not have a nose? And then where would the line be? On your cheek, where is the line dividing nose from cheek on the skin? You realize there's no such line. You could make an arbitrary one and say, well, my nose, I'm going to count up to here and there, but that's arbitrary. Then remember, a line, technically, has no width, right? To be an exact line, it cannot have a width. So in a way, the line is not there, even, right? Just like any point you might touch on your nose, if you had a computer, if you were a plastic surgeon showing someone different noses to have a nose job, you know, giving them like a shopping for a nose in a plastic surgeon, they'd show you like a grid with lots of points on it, you know, or like it looked like a Mercator projection of a nose. And then they'd press buttons and it would go big and small and round and all kinds of things, right? Nose, the nostrils displayed that way. But every single point in that projection, every X, Y, Z, remember, a point has no size. So a point is an abstraction. So actually no point on the nose is there. You get it? This is meditating. I'm leading you through a meditating, so I hope you're meditating on this. So any point, even if you, not a finger, but you had like a needle tip point, you touch very gently, not make a wound, that actually that needle tip is not a point. It's still a little bit of a round circle that it touches. You know, it's like acupuncture needle. So a point is actually not even as big as the tip of a Chinese acupuncture needle, much less Genlan's chopstick. So basically, you can dissolve under analysis your nose, and you can also use whatever you know about quantum physics, even atomic physics. You know, the atoms, you know, every atom has a tiny nucleus, and then there's an electron shooting around, and they always give the analogy like it's a flea on home plate in a giant baseball stadium, and then there's one flea flying around somewhere in the bleachers. And that's all the solid matter in an atom, but because if we're hurling around so fast, it makes it seem like something solid, but it isn't. And then quantum people go into the nucleus and they go into the electron, and that comes apart completely, right? So you can go into that thought experiment. And therefore, the point is, then in the Heart Sutra, it says, no nose. No eye, no ear, no nose. You get it? So what that means is it's referring to meditative thought experiment where your nose and its atoms and its cells and its molecules and its subatomic particles dissolved under your analysis. And when you can do that with a very one-pointed, powerful concentration, then you really will, your nose will actually disappear, and the one you who's looking at it will also disappear. I mean, that's where that emptiness experience seems to come from. And then when that happens, you have the momentum of inquiry, and then the disappearance disappears, and it's back. And so basically you have a relative nose, which means it's there, it's your hood ornaments in front of you, but if you try to look for it and pinpoint it and say, this is my real nose, my intrinsically real nose, my substantially real nose, then you will not be able to find it. You follow me? And this has very powerful, the deeper you take this, the more you work on this, the more you critically develop this, the deeper it comes. Then, you know, the more everything seems to be like an illusion, like a reflection in a mirror around you. You get what's called the mirror wisdom, mirror-like wisdom. Now, you add to that. Now, what that means, though, and a lot of people, Zen people in the West, and even in China and Japan, in history, even in Asia, they misunderstood this into thinking that, you know, emptiness was sort of like nothingness, and the nature of the world was it's all nothing because it'll disappear. And that's totally wrong. That's absolutely wrong. Emptiness means it's all totally there, but it's there with a mirror image reflection or illusion-like quality. And therefore, the realization of emptiness means that your perception of any seeming object is an interaction where you, the subject, are very powerful in determining your experience of that object. And therefore, you have to become responsible for shaping that experience yourself. So it completely actually locks you into relativity in a very creative way, rather than escaping you from it into some nothingness or some empty space, as people totally misunderstand what voidness or emptiness really means. Okay? Now, in that thing of you're locked into it, then what you become is you become an artist shaping it. And, of course, the ultimate artist of shaping it is Buddha. That's what it is, because that being has become energy-wise one with everything, so it can sort of shape it out of inside of itself, something like that. Vast being. You know? And so it can shape, but it has no reason to shape it in any way, because they feel infinite and they feel totally blissful. So they don't have to shape it. They don't have to adopt a body. They could adopt a million bodies or no body. They don't care. But they realize that other people do care, who don't realize its true nature, who are not joyful and blissful, who are fighting off the universe and losing the fight. Therefore, in samsara, suffering, feeling an isolated, alienated being, different from everything around it, frightened of everything around it, or greedy to swallow everything around it, try to be bigger to withstand everything, but you can't swallow infinity. So always losing. And so in that second thing, once you realize that by realizing the nature of emptiness, you then start reshaping. You start to become an artist of reshaping. And of course, the great art of reshaping out of compassion for the benefit of others is to help heal them, is the soa rikpa, is the medicine reshaping. And Buddha, particularly this Shakyamuni Buddha, they say, because he took rebirth, he performed his attaining Buddhahood in a time in the planet when the human beings only had a 100-year lifespan, and they tended to be kind of cranky and violent, greedy, and crazy and have a hard time. And also they tended to get sick a lot, so they couldn't study, they couldn't meditate, they couldn't understand, he couldn't help them, therefore. Because the only way he could help people is by stimulating their understanding so that they understand their own interconnected nature, their own basic freedom within that interconnected nature, and their own infinite horizon of positive joy, blissful development for the benefit of self and other. Only through their understanding. They cannot be indoctrinated. They cannot do it by blind faith. They cannot be pressed or forced into that. They have to open themselves to the force, you could say, the force of love and compassion, the diamond force of love and compassion, right? Which George Lucas didn't even know he was talking about, but he was. So that's the second piece that the Vimalakirti thing opens up. And then the rest of that whole sutra, and even in a way the whole Mahayana sutra, is dealing with this issue of how do we take advantage and use our very, very precious human life to the best evolutionary advantage, to understand our true nature. Because it is only by understanding our true nature, which we are totally capable. Buddha has great faith in us that we are capable of doing that. But it is only by that understanding, finally, that we will be really happy and we will become really free and really blissful. So wisdom is the source of that bliss, actually. Anyway, so that's the Nangirimpa for today.